Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Hi, Nick and Sarah, doing well, thanks. Getting ready for the next cold snap, but in the meantime, I've got you guys to keep me company.
Yes, enjoying the mild winter days. It's a special pleasure because the cold snaps remind us of how glorious they are. And of course, we are also joined by Ms. Sarah Gon. Sarah, how are you doing?
I'm well. I'm sort of getting cold in anticipation of tomorrow's cold snap. So I'm
in the cold room. Excellent. All right. First thing we're going to mention, we're not going to go into a whole discussion on this, but maybe just get your guys' thoughts on this. The Health Minister, Joe Bartler, has issued a memo last night saying there's been a big decline in the number of hospitalized people and poor health indicators and all that stuff and COVID infections. And so we are going to recommend to the President and the National Coronavirus Command Council that they get rid of the remaining COVID-19 regulations, specifically mask wearing and restrictions on venues and gatherings. Bit late, but still, I think welcome news. Chris?
David in the chat asked the question, why was nobody at the president's auction wearing masks? And I think that's because when you spend taxpayer money on livestock, COVID can't get you. So just to answer that particular question. Yeah, it was interesting. Obviously, this weekend we had the final between the Stormers and the Bulls of the URC. And you had still restrictions, of course, but you had everyone packed into very tight space next to each other. So it was at full capacity for what was allowed, but everyone packed together. So does it actually, was it quote unquote following the science as it was supposed to be? I think that was the latest example of that these regulations, when implemented, don't actually lead to things like social distancing and that sort of thing. I mean, that's probably been the case in South Africa for the last 2 years. For the majority of citizens who are packed in 10 people into a small room because of their socioeconomic conditions, but then you expect that to work for them kind of thing. That was the latest example of these regulations. But also I want to highlight just the work of civil society organizations that shouldn't be discounted. So organizations such as, of course, the Institute of Race Relations, SAKALIGA, DRSA, AfriForum, others, to slowly but surely pressure government to abandon these regulations. Don't discount the work that goes into campaigns for these organizations behind the scenes, the coordination in terms of organizations trying to individually at least make sure that they're the strongest cases when they go to court, all that sort of stuff. And that's possible because people who watch this show and others fund our work. So I think it's a win, and sign our
petitions. Sarah, any thoughts?
As they say in the northeast of Joburg, mazel tov. these regulations could have been in the last bunch of regulations that disappeared. And this sort of, we will recommend to the, but I must say I'm relieved. I cannot wait to get rid of masks. Right. In fact, the funny thing is I happen to bump into one of our colleague Gabriel Krauser yesterday, and he's been spearheading the campaign against mask wearing and then the petition, and he was wearing the creepiest mask I have probably ever seen. I mean, I'm sitting in a public place and he suddenly appears. So the one advantage is I hate masks, so it'll be nice. And the other advantage is no one can scare me again.
I must say, I had a certain fondness for them because they felt like they did give a sort of emotional distance from other people in public. That's, and as true, someone who doesn't, that's like true, going outside, that was always quite pleasant. But anyway, just to be clear, though, they are not repealed. They are still in force. This is just a recommendation. And we have had it before where the health minister recommended something and the presidency decided not to comply, at least for a while. So let's see how this goes. But I suspect the end of the COVID period is near. All right, so let's move on to our first proper story for today. And this is about a report that's come out from NGO Section 27 and a consultancy group called the Concentric Alliance. They issued a report where they asked a whole bunch of people from around the healthcare sector, what their thoughts were on the National Health Insurance Scheme, which is, of course, government's sort of flagship healthcare reform program. And they were looking at how to fix what they called the fatal stagnation in the healthcare sector. So they interviewed people from provincial health departments, national health departments, health regulators, private medical schemes, public and private healthcare workers, trade unions, private hospital groups, as among others. They note that the private healthcare sector is a pretty big part of South Africa's economy. It's a large employer. It employs many people who, for example, nurses will work part-time in the public hospitals and then also work in the private hospitals as well for extra money. So it's welcome also for a lot of public healthcare workers. The report found that there was a lot of opposition to a very particular section of the NHI, and that is the part of the NHI which effectively bans private health insurance. So it doesn't completely ban private health insurance, but basically what it says, you can't get private health insurance unless it's for something that NHI doesn't cover. So that means that you essentially have to go onto NHI, and the net result of this will probably be that most healthcare plans will be eliminated, and the ones that will be left will be very expensive premium ones for people who have complicated health conditions or high risk of things like that. So obviously not ideal. Section 27 found at the end of their report that the current approach to this draft provision, that being the abolition of private health insurance, has the potential to undermine the implementation of the NHI and delay urgent reform to the health system. So, Chris, let me start with you. I think this is a welcome finding from them, that they're recognizing some of the problems in NHI. What do you make of this?
Yeah, and part of the report that also say that all this focus on the NHI means that reforms that could be made in healthcare to increase access to quality care, for example, simply haven't happened. So we had the health market inquiry a few years ago that points to serious issues structurally, both in the private and public sectors, that could be implemented and rectified. But all this focus on this pie in the sky NHI is distracting from all that work. It's obviously easy to sell quote unquote universal health coverage and with emotive language versus doing the hard work of policy reform, looking at regulations that drive up costs both for the private and public sectors, all that sort of stuff. So kudos to Section 27 for bringing out this report and pointing out to the serious issues with the NHI. Also important to highlight just the concentration of power that it would lead to, especially for the Minister of Health, who would have the power to appoint NHI fund board members. So never mind the last 10 years of state capture and everyone, of course, but a lot of people wondering, how did this happen? You know, what brought this about? If you keep on mixing the state and the economy to this extent, don't be surprised when you incentivize more cronyism and corruption. It's simply going to bring up that incentive.
Right. The health minister would, in effect, be able to control the vast majority of all medical health spending in the country, which would make them so powerful that would be, I can't see that making anything, much less the internal politics of the ANC, much healthier. I'm sure Zweli Mkhize is rather bitter that he is no longer the minister in that department. Specifically, I've always suspected that he was minister. My pet theory is that he was sticking in that health minister position precisely because he wanted to get his hands on the NHI pot when it was implemented. Sara, no, perfect. What do you make of this?
Sorry, I just wanted to mention one more thing. Just on the sorry, I got distracted now. On the role of doctors and nurses, that this would, especially heading out of COVID and tighter economic times and low growth in South Africa, you need to make the policy choices that incentivize people to stay in your country. So if you make it more difficult for them to work or you increase the state's power over them, you're going to incentivize them to leave the country. They might not want to. They might love South Africa. They might want to stay here and work and, you know, give back and all that sort of stuff. But at some point, they need to work and also make a living. So if you implement something like the NHI, you're going to drive doctors and nurses away. And that, I mean, and specialists. And don't think that those people, you're just going to find them behind every bush kind of thing. That's a lot of years of study and work and sacrifices and all that sort of thing that doesn't happen overnight. But you whittle away that availability of specialists and people who care about their country if you implement policies such as the NHI. Sorry, Sarah.
No, it's fine. In fact, just to pick up on that point, I'll use my husband as an example. He spent 12 years studying to get to the point where he could practice as he is. And it's I think the problem is that the government doesn't understand anything about anything. I mean, one of the things I noted, I think this was probably a couple of years ago now, that in all public hospitals will have to meet a certain standard to be NHI hospitals. And at the time it was, and it's probably more now, 83% of public hospitals do not meet that standard. So then we come to the problem of we create NHI and then what's underneath it? Rotting hospitals and poor service delivery. I mean, the logical thing would be to say, beef up the hospitals, put the right people in management, make sure they don't go up in flames. You will serve many more people that way. You don't have to make things complicated. And because the NHI would be so unbelievably expensive, and the layers of administration would be so extensive, the using it as a vehicle for corruption is it's just irresistible. And it's just, you know, it's one of those matters that I'm just not quite sure what to say about it because it is such a bad idea. That's, you know, you're taking a healthcare system that if you could improve the public, you've got a good private healthcare system, or it still is good. There must be a way of using the private healthcare system to help the public system. And I'm sure they would, particularly if you promised to keep your hands off their businesses. It's that monolithic, it's very much in the sort of nationalized, you know, the institutions of power. You haven't built the institution yet, but you nationalize it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. This is a recurring problem with the way that government looks at problems, which is that it thinks that the solution is always more money. And the idea behind NHI is that you're basically going to take money out of the private sector and give it to the public sector. But the problem is not just money. The problem is actually probably more how well you spend that money. Mm-hmm. And NHI is going to charge us more and give us less. It's just going to add more inefficiency to the whole system. And if you want to kill your middle class, you make sure they can't get private healthcare. Because if people have to go to the public hospitals, I have a friend who died in a public hospital probably because they didn't give her the treatment that she required. They didn't give her proper dialysis. It's not the kind of place you ever want to end up unless you have to. And it is going to do more to affect brain drain, I think, than any other policy that government has promulgated in the last 28 years.
Can I just mention that, I mean, I've been around, you know, obviously prior to 1994, and there were elements in the public health system that were absolutely superb. I mean, world-class, world-beating. And, you know, hospitals were by and large, the big hospitals were run by people who had hospital experience. Hospital management is, of course, available. I don't know if anyone attends it, but, I mean, I have absolutely no faith in the people who run Rahima Musa and Charlotte Makeke.
Right. It's dreadful. Know, this is the consequence of cater deployment, is that people who don't, you know, run these things get put in charge of them. Chris, final thoughts from you.
Yeah, just if I may, in my hubris, give advice to medical aid administrators, but also members. I mean, you as a member have the power, especially at AGMs and other avenues, to voice this issue with the management of your medical aid. Don't assume that if you support the NHI in rhetoric and say, yes, we support universal healthcare and we'll work with government, that you'll be immune from the pernicious effects thereof. As government becomes more desperate for control and just funds, which will dry up if more taxpayers leave, they will implement the harshest version of an NHI. So imagine the worst case scenario, which is inevitable because government's going to continue wanting to control more and more and more. So don't play on either government's moral turf or on their sort of technical, practical turf. The expertise isn't in the Department of Health, unfortunately, National Health, to run a system that monopolizes the management of all healthcare, no matter, you know, no matter the good people that you get in charge there on the board, all that sort of stuff, the incentives are geared towards cronyism and inefficiencies that will ultimately not be good for especially poor South Africans who could be getting access to better healthcare if the right regulations and reforms were brought in. Yeah.
That's exactly the point I wanted. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Can I just comment on that? The thing about you say about AGMs, etc. It's actually, I think, relatively easy for the public who belong to health, to medical aids, to protest. And it doesn't have to be standing outside with banners. It's about attending the AGM. It's about writing letters. It's perhaps about putting in petitions. Because somewhere along the line, I get the impression that the medical aid industry is talking about NHI, and no one is paying any attention to the people who pay for the medical aid services. It's just bizarre.
Yeah.
So, John, just as a, people must get active.
As a final point, it's not, to the sort of medical aids. As one example, this happened with mineral rights in South Africa. Mining companies played on government's turf and they were promised X, Y, and Z, and no, things wouldn't decline, and no, we would leave you alone kind of thing. We're seeing it all around us now. So don't cede the ground in the first place. There are better reforms that could be made than an NHI.
Yeah,
exactly. And if anyone ever says, oh, you're just complaining because you're sort of a middle-class person and you don't want to pay more in taxes to help the poor, it is people who have worked very hard to drag themselves out of poverty, who have just managed to afford that cheapest hospital plan and medical aid thing to escape the government hospitals, who are going to be the most harshly affected by this, because they will certainly not be able to afford private healthcare after NHI has passed. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic. And this is about the city of Johannesburg, where, according to BizTech, who interviewed a number of property developers around Johannesburg, who asked to remain anonymous, which I think says something about the way that city planning is done in Johannesburg. there's an element of fear here. They said that there are several projects worth billions of rands that would employ thousands of people in the city and that have been on hold for 2 years or longer with no progress in getting rezoning approvals from the city. The main issue relates to water infrastructure upgrades. They said in the past a rezoning application would be submitted to the city and proceed to a comment period. Joburg Water has been standing in the way of the same. There needs to be more upgrades to the infrastructure before development can go ahead. But it's not isolated to these developers as well. I know a property developer, and I was at a dinner relatively recently, and he was talking about how there are almost no projects that are moving ahead in the city of Johannesburg in particular, but across a lot of municipalities in Gauteng, because government zoning is just not happening. Government city planning is just not happening. And I suspect that sometimes this is due to inefficiency. Sometimes it's due to legitimate concerns about infrastructure, which we know is under a lot of strain in the big cities. But some of it, I'm sure, is purposely slow in the hopes that bribes will be forthcoming in order to expedite the process. Sarah, what do you make of all this?
Look, I agree with you. I do think infrastructure is a problem. I mean, I know around our area, which is an old suburb, that pipes keep breaking with irregularly because they do need replacing, and I'm sure the city doesn't have the money to go to replace the infrastructure to the extent that it needs. But I also know that the department in the city councils, in the city council, let's talk about Joburg. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard I'm not sure I've ever heard a good word said about it. And going there is generally, I've been there once and it was a dispiriting experience and it was a small issue. But I think, you know, the problem with something like housing, as soon as the government has the authority stroke power to grant you something without which you cannot act, it is open for either just because you're a mean bastard who wants to, you know, exert your power, or the bribes are being, you know, one cannot discount bribery. I mean, just in another area, okay, national home affairs. I know someone who, an immigrant who's got the right papers, etc., but he cannot get the papers his wife needs, and he's been backwards and forwards umpteen times. And unless he pays the guy $10,000, his wife's not going to be registered. So it's that power. It's so easy to exert that power to the cause of corruption. And I mean, one hopes it's not what the problem is in Joburg, but one can't discount it.
I think it was the MMC. So of course, Joburg is currently governed by this, you know, complicated coalition, which involves pretty much everyone except the ANC, AIC and IFP, and EFF, I guess. And I'm pretty sure that the Coalition MMC for Development Planning, which is the department that oversees precisely zoning, a couple of months ago, I think we covered it on the show, actually say, accused some of her own employees of sabotaging the development planning digitization plan in order to ensure that the corruption could continue without being detected. So it's not just us saying this, even the government itself seems to be well aware of this. But I think it does speak to Joburg's in this horrible position now where, you know, you've got corrupt officials, you've got creaking infrastructure, you've got a lack of resources. I know the other day, the mayor, Paul Palazzi, said that it's going to take 10 times the infrastructure budget just to fix the backlog of infrastructure stuff they have. And so it's all sort of coming together now where, as Joburg Water makes clear in this report to BizTech, that they just don't have great water infrastructure available. Chris, what do you make of this?
No, not a lot of substance to add to what you've both said, just again pointing to incentives and systems and getting the right sort of institutions in place. So it'll take a long time to reverse this, which isn't to say that we shouldn't hold to account the current coalition and the current administration, even though it might be more difficult than it might have been just coming into a normal, clean-run sort of administration with finances. But yeah, this, when you don't get these small things right, then perverse incentives take off pretty quickly. And again, great opportunities for job creation potentially lost. Just in general, South Africa's construction industry has been held hostage by all sorts of lobby groups and pressure groups. But again, when you mix the state and the economy, you incentivize those with deeper pockets to ensure that systems are set up to favor them and that they can get quicker access to permits and all that sort of stuff. That's simply going to be inevitable, unfortunately. Maybe we'll see slowly. I don't think there'll be a clear break or anything of the stasis or the sort of instability, but maybe things will shift a little bit, and then slowly but surely, the sort of the backlog will eventually start like shifting in different ways. And at the same time, you have hopefully businesses taking their own steps to build and invest in infrastructure in ways that is state-proof, in ways that it hasn't been up until this point.
To bring up a point that I went on about back when the coalition took over Joburg, is this is precisely issues like this why I worried that such a shaky coalition would not be a great idea in Joburg, because as is clear from this report, the problems in Johannesburg run very, very deep, and it's going to take a long time to fix them. And not just a long time, but also some very tough decisions are going to need to be made in order to make sure that the money and expertise is available. Sarah?
Can I make a suggestion to the MMC? Because I really sympathise with it. Start holding some disciplinary inquiries about some fairly senior middle level, the sort of people who will often obstruct what the junior people do or don't do. Hold some disciplinary inquiries. You've got incapacity. You've got probably insolence. I forget the other word. All of those things. Have a proper inquiry. Fire them. If you start getting rid of people who are rotten, you can just get rid of one or two and it changes the way a department operates and how they operate. And I suspect you've probably got people there who've been there 20 years and theoretically have a rap sheet up to here, who you could get. To try and go for the whole department isn't worth it, but to just get a few senior people and show that you're prepared to do it, you're not tolerating this shit anymore. Joburg Infrastructure brings it out to me. just apply a little bit of traditional labor law and see how it goes.
No, I think that's a really good point. People are so scared of labor law that they don't even begin to follow the process.
Can I just say one of the things is that they're scared of it because government suspends. Now, suspension is sometimes warranted, but not always. And they use it like a club. Put someone on suspension, then we'll figure out what to do with them. You may or may not need to suspend, depending on the circumstances. You have as much possible of your evidence. You may need to get evidence after, before you even do it. And then hold the hearing. Now, the process of holding the hearing is not insubstantial, but it shouldn't take more than a few days to hold the hearing. It may take a while to get the evidence, but that's what you do. You do not put on eternal suspension. And you put a guy on suspension if he may fiddle with your computers or information that you've got, then you should, by all means, but get it done within a month.
Exactly so. All right, so let's move on to our final topic for today, and this is about the ongoing energy crisis in Europe connected to the war in Ukraine. So as the war has been going on, a big part of the politics around the conflict has been the European Union's purchase of oil and gas and other sort of energy materials from Russia, which Ukraine has been very upset about because they say that it has funded the war. And Russia has taken a number of steps to use its sale of these resources as leverage to try and get sanctions lessened on it. Well, recently, Russia has begun to reduce the amount of gas that they are piping to some of the European Union nations, which are quite hostile to it, specifically Germany and the Netherlands. I believe the Netherlands in particular imports about 15% of its gas from Russia, and I think it's over a third of Germany's gas comes from Russia. At least that was before the conflict. I'm not sure what it is at now. Anyway, this is causing energy shortages, which has forced both Germany and the Netherlands to enact what they call energy crisis plans. So the Netherlands, which had pretty strict regulations about how much coal could be burned in its coal power plants, has said that it is lifting the caps on production by coal-fired power plants to reduce its reliance on Russian gas. The Dutch energy minister said, quote, "With these measures, less money will flow to Putin's war chest." Germany's economic minister has also announced that they will be reopening a number of coal-fired power plants to lifting caps on those coal-fired power plants specifically as well to make up for shortfalls in energy caused by lack of gas and oil. These countries are also looking at reopening gas projects. So the Netherlands is restarting its Groningen gas drilling operations, and Germany is looking at buying a large amount of gas from Qatar to supplement to get away from Russian raw materials. But that still seems to be quite a long way off. So energy is playing a big role in the conflict. But Sarah, there's an annoying aspect to this, which is to me, it just the nuclear seems to be kind of mostly absent from the discussion again.
Mm. I truly don't get it. I mean, as I said earlier, we were discussing it. And I think people, even leaders of countries, you say nuclear and they see, the nuclear bomb going off in Hiroshima. Now, nuclear power for the purpose of lighting cities, etc., and nuclear power and the sort of nuclear power that you need to let off a bomb, they are actually quite different. They can be, the waste can be safely dealt with. I think the problem is you've got much of Europe has sort of bought into the green stroke climate change position. And it's almost like there's a regressive, we must take people back to 100 years ago when such things like nuclear are not, we're not around. So what happens? We're now ending up with coal, viva coal. We're going back to.
Which is the dirtiest.
Exactly. I mean, but if they need it, they misuse it. But the point is that the lack of reality, the lack of sort of looking at really saying, how do we provide for our citizens energy? Oh, let's have a few windmills and then suddenly the gas cuts off and you don't, my advice is you never, never rely substantially on a country to provide energy that is autocratic. And that includes Qatar.
Well, if you're buying gas from Qatar, that's not going to be great either if your intention is to escape dodgy geopolitics. But that's, a discussion for another day. Chris, final thoughts on this before we close the episode?
Yeah, I mean, for the last, decade at least, oil industry and investors, they were told that the age of oil is over. So they mothballed equipment, they shut down plants and refineries and all that sort of stuff, and now they have to ramp up again with higher demand. So now we're seeing high prices, strikes just in Belgium, for example, started yesterday about cost of living. So Europe is in for a tough time, I think, for the next while, maybe enjoying a particular South African export in the form of load shedding. But yeah, just in terms of emerging market countries needing to to make sure that they aren't subject to just global forces and global events, that they have their own capacity to some extent, but also that they aren't just reliant on funding for only renewables. So I just recently started reading a new book by Alex Epstein. He's written quite a bit on this topic, but his new book, Fossil Future, Why Global Human Flourishing Requires More Oil, Coal, and Natural Gas, Not Less. So it'll be interesting to see just some of the data and arguments that he uses, especially for developing countries such as South Africa. And unfortunately, despite some in governments wishing this, we can't just import everything from Russia because we chose to shut down our own refineries.
Oh, wonderful. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please subscribe to it if you enjoyed it. Please support the Institute of Race Relations by submitting your name to 32823. It's on the banner behind me if you're watching on YouTube. And yeah, leave us good reviews on the podcast apps, all that good stuff. We'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a great one, everyone. Cheers.